Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview, where our guest today is Linwood Barclay, a frequent guest. We love talking to Linwood. We're going to be talking about his new book, The Lie Maker. Our reviewer, Ray Palin, had this to say about it. The Lie Maker is filled with such imaginative plot twists and turns that it becomes physically impossible to put the book down at any point. It's easily one of the best thrillers of 2023. It also received this praise from that small paper, The Wall Street Journal. It takes a gifted writer to perfectly balance all the suspense, wit, violence, and poignance in a book such as this. Lucky for us, Mr. Barclay is one of the best in the business. Oh, and yes, it's going to be a Book Reporter bets on selection. You know, Book Reporter, the new Wall Street Journal, and me. Okay, so there you go, folks. Welcome, Linwood. So great to see you as always.
It's so nice to see you, Carol.
Always so let's begin by you telling us a little bit about The Lie Maker. What's the plot about this time?
Sure. So The Lie Maker is about a writer named Jack Gibbons. And Jack Gibbons is not a very successful writer. He's had a couple books out that were particularly well received, but didn't sell a whole lot. And so he's about to consider a career working in trade magazines when he is approached with a very unusual offer by the folks who are with the Witness Relocation Program. And they say to him, look, we're really good at protecting people and setting them up in another place and so forth, but we're not very creative. And these people need new backstories, a created backstory that they can tell people, oh, I'm from here, I'm from there. And we've read your books, and yeah, you didn't sell a lot, but you have a really good sense of character and so forth. And we would like to hire you to write the backstories for these people. And they're offering a fair chunk of change too. And not only does Jack think this is kind of interesting offer, but it's particularly interesting because clearly what they're unaware of is that when he was a kid, his own father left him and his mom and went into the witness protection program because he was testifying against a very bad person. And the mother, Jack's mom, thought, I'm not paying for your mistakes. We're not going with you. And his dad went off the program. Jack grew up under another name when his mom met somebody else. And so with this, having been approached by the agency, he thinks, well, if I work for them, maybe I can worm my way into their hearts, and they'll connect me all these years later with my father. And as often is the case in these kind of books, mayhem ensues.
Absolutely, mayhem ensues. What inspired you to write it? Like witness protection, is it something you've given thought to?
Well, at first I was thinking about doing a book about, I actually had the idea, I think it'd be great to do a TV series that was just about witness protection program. And then I thought, oh, I don't know enough about it. And then I thought, what if I narrowed the focus completely down and brought it to a character that I know something about as a writer? And I thought, there's my angle. And then the other thing that sort of worked its way into the story is, and I'm going to reach over to my desk here. And what I have to show you here is, you know, that something that becomes somewhat pivotal in the novel is that when Jack's father leaves, mm-hmm. the last thing he does is he gives his son his wallet. He says, here, take this. There's a few bucks in it. And he certainly doesn't need any of the ID that's in it because they're going to create him all new ones. So this, what I have here in my hand, this is my father's wallet.
Wow.
And this has been, my dad died when I was 16. He was only 59 years old. And I always hung on to this wallet. And this wallet has always been in whatever desk I had at the time. And it's been in my desk for more than half a century.
Wow.
One day on Twitter, I just posted a picture of the wallet. And I said, this is my dad's wallet. He died when I was 16. It's been in my desk for 50 years. I just said that. And Stephen King saw that. He retweeted it, and it just went nuts.
Wow.
So all these people said, I still have my mother's, you know, letters. I still have my dad's hat. You know, all this stuff started just coming out, just bubbling to the surface. And I thought, there's something there. Mm-hmm. And so this wallet became part of the novel.
So is there any money in that wallet?
No, but you know what there is?
What? It's ID?
There's a driver's license, car insurance, membership with the Masons, and a picture of me.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's the wallet.
A picture of me. And also in here, because we had moved to Canada, his a photostat of his landed immigrant status in Canada, having moved up from the U.S. That's in
the
wallet.
Oh, my gosh. Very
cool.
So,
yeah, so I've always had this. And, you know, what can I say? What do we got here? I don't remember this. This is library card.
Oh, I love it. This is great. So there.
So that's kind of where that whole book came. That's how it kind of came together.
So there's this really great line at the start. And it said, "Your dad's not a good person. Your dad killed people's son." Did you always have that line? Because it's a killer line. It's just there.
Oh, yeah. I wish that I did. You know what? I had written that chapter and I got to the end and there was something else there. And it was my agent, Helen Heller, who said, you know what would be a better line there would be something along the lines of this. So it pains me greatly to have to say that someone else deserves some credit for that line. You have no idea how that cuts deeply.
Okay, I'm sorry. But I like that Jack retorts, can you not just say sorry? Because that's what he gets in his head that kids do. When you do something bad, you can just say you're sorry. And yeah. At a very young age, he learns you can't just do that. So I just thought that was so appropriate.
Dad says there's some things that sorry won't cut it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
killing people is on that list.
Killing people, stealing stuff from bad people, those are the things. So Jack's left with his mom, and there are lots of questions about why they didn't leave. Like, he really kind of says to his mother, like, why didn't we go? Why didn't we do this? He doesn't understand this is his dad's problem. The mother's laying it on him, blah, blah, blah. So it puts him in a really precarious place because he's a boy, and he sort of needs his mom, or his dad, rather, and dad's not there. And then mom brings on the stepdad that's not the dad you wanted either. He's not the your dad out of the box, but he's a pretty interesting character in Earl.
Yeah, Earl is this stepdad who comes in. And Earl's not really a villain, but Earl's kind of a loser. Earl is always looking for a get-rich scheme, you know, something that so he can coast for a long time. And if he gets a whole lot of money here, and I mean, it's funny, I'm trying to remember what it was, because I wrote the book a while ago, right? I'm trying to remember what, I think he sunk a whole bunch of money into some sort of a health food store between a Burger King and a McDonald's or something. And that didn't fly, who knows why. And he ended up putting more money into some units in a Florida high rise that pancaked, that crushed.
Right. Right.
So when Jack is just like, got no money.
Right.
And Earl's asking him for loans. You know, can I get some money? He says, you don't get it. And Earl's one of these people who has a lot of misconceptions about the publishing industry, that once you get a book published, well, you never have to work again. And so Earl's kind of, but Earl does play an important role as the story goes on.
Yeah, as things move along. You know, I've always thought that with witness protection, you get whisked away. What do you get to keep? What do you get to lose? You know, like what do you lose in the, you know, as you're leaving? And it ends up that you don't take much. You take like yourself and your family. Lisa Scottolini wrote about this in her last thriller, What Happened to the Bennets? And the entire family disappears, but you realize that they're still looking for you at book club. They're still wondering where you are at school. You're just gone. And I never really thought about that. So is this an idea you've ruminated on for a while of like, you're gone and gone?
Not too much. I mean, I think I was really focused on Jack and what this does to a kid. It's funny, I was doing an interview on TV the other day and they said, wow, this is fascinating. Does the witness protection program really do this, hire writers to write backstories? And I said, they do in this book.
This is the one, folks. This is where you get it, you know?
They do it in this book.
Yeah.
Now, I have to just interject here. If it looks like I've got some sort of sunburn on my face, it's because this is my office, and the sun sets right there, and I've pulled these blinds down. The sun's still coming through, and it looks like, I hope his face doesn't burst into flames. You know, looks a bit, at least on my monitor, it looks that way.
No, you're just a thriller writer. We're totally fine with it. If it bursts into flames and being like, wow, look what he pulled off, right. You know, like seriously, you know, but I love that Jack gets this job writing these bios for the people. And then all of a sudden you realize it's like, maybe I need to meet the person, because right. If the guy is like 6'10" or something like that, he's not going to be able to fit in this kind of a job or that kind of a job. So we need some basic characteristics. And he asks to do this. And it's kind of pivotal in the book that he does this.
That's right. Because they say to him, just start writing backstories, just start writing some, and they just sort of without knowing anything. So he starts writing, and that's when he realizes, well, look, you know, what am I supposed to do? Say this guy's a rodeo clown or what, you know, and it turns out he's very serious and, you know, like it just doesn't fit. So that's when he says, he concludes, he says, what I'm trying to do is make a suit for someone that I can't measure. Mm-hmm. And so he insists that he wants to meet the individual for whom he's writing this first backstory. Right. And so this whole thing has to be set up, and they have to take him out to this isolated location. He's got to be blindfolded, can't know where he's going, so that he can meet this guy. And I think then the guy meets him at the door and says, so you're my lie maker. You know, you're my guy who's going to create this backstory for me. And, you know, and I think that's a real kind of eye opener at that point for Jack, because he starts to get a sense, knowing what this guy has been going through and these sort of very bad people who were looking for him, the sort of stuff that his father must have gone through.
Right.
And it's not a lot of spoiler, just to sort of whet the appetite. You know, he spends all his time trying, he starts to see whether in fact they would connect him mm-hmm. with his dad. And when they sort of make some inquiries about whether to decide whether to do this, they can't find him. Mm-hmm. And it becomes possible that maybe Jack's long lost dad is in some kind of deep trouble.
Well, everyone who's listening right now, I just want you to know that this is the book I was reading until 3 a.m. And the next night I read it till 3 a.m. And the only reason I stopped is because I had to work the next day, because the book is that good, because you're going to get on this ride and it's going to be, oh, I'll just read a little bit more. And it's 3 a.m. So 2-3 a.m. nights. There you go.
Yeah, but what you're not telling him is you don't start reading until 1 a.m., right?
No, I do. One night I started late. The other night I started earlier. But no, I finished another book and I was like, I'm going to pick this up. And then it's like, oh no, you're not just picking this up. You're in for the ride. You're there. So then we've got Lana, his girlfriend, is this terrific character. She works for a newspaper, as you did, which I think you had a little bit of fun with that. Because whenever you put somebody in the newspaper business, it's always they can't get the story they exactly want. There's always something they want that doesn't connect.
Or they're sent to cover something that they really have no interest in covering, or, you know, like the obligations of what they have to do. And I have to be really careful. Nobody who works at a newspaper ever says scoop. I just want to make that known right now. Nobody ever says, I've got a scoop. Unless they're in like a 1930s movie. Doesn't happen.
Right.
So, because a lot of newspaper work is kind of an immense amount of drudgery, interrupted by occasional holy mackerel stuff, you know, which I know well. Excuse me.
The holy mackerel you're really into. The holy mackerel you're there for.
So, I mean, I worked 3 decades at newspapers. And, you know, and I can remember coming in on him when he came in on the midnight editing shift on the overnight desk on the city desk, and coming in at 11 o'clock at night. And when they tell you, boy, it's a quiet, dead night, that's nobody should even say that, because the night that somebody said that to me at 11:20, the whole world just blew up, you know. Right. So it's an interesting location. So I think it's the kind of thing I can, you know, certainly when I have characters who work in newspapers, I feel I can bring a little authenticity to it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And also, she comes from this wealthy family, and family is stressed here more than her wealth. I think Jack loves the idea that she has a family, but he's very cognizant that he doesn't have one to introduce her to. Like, meet Earl, not going to go so well. And I think that he wants her to know more of him. But that would be meeting his dad. That would not be who we have to say he's seen a couple of times through the years. Like, he's seen his dad a couple of times, but his dad's now missing and he really wants this woman in his life. But I think he really wants her to meet somebody that mattered to him as well. And there's nobody left. Yeah,
and I think he also wants to be straight with her. Look, before, you know, I popped a question, or before we settled together, there's stuff you need to know about me. You need to know about my background. And he wants to be straight with her. So he would like her to meet his dad. He would like his dad to meet her and know that he's grown up, he's found someone special and so forth. And you try to look at it from his girlfriend's point of view to find out, oh, so my boyfriend is, here's dad was a hired killer. Mm. That's a new one.
Yeah.
I thought my dad was just weird collecting toy trains or whatever, you know, but this is on another level.
Whole different level here. And then, you know, the example of like random things that happen. I love that Lana carries things like a hard hat and a safety vest in the trunk of her car. Like these things come up. So she's reporting on the
standard. That is standard equipment. Yeah.
So she's got all this stuff. And what she was carrying, I never would have thought about. Like, I never would have thought, but you weave these things in. So even the back of the car, I feel like I'm seeing everything that's happening in this book. When you're writing these characters, do you sketch out what they're going to do in advance or draw them in advance? Or do they just happen as you're going?
It kind of happens as I go.
Okay.
I like to know the big picture, overall picture of the story, like the whole sort of overall arc. Mm-hmm. But the opportunities that exist don't really... I'm not aware of them until I kind of get to them and think, oh, I could do this, I could do that. It's like if you get in a car in New York and you're driving to LA, you know where you're going to end up, but you have 100 ways to get there.
Right.
So it's kind of like that, you know, but it's true. I mean, I knew all these guys. I was, most of my time in newspapers was either as an editor or a columnist, but you know, I watched how the really great investigative reporters know what they did. I mean, they kept the clipboard and the hard hat in the trunk because they said you can go just about anywhere with a hard hat and a clipboard. Like you just could go into anything, you know.
Just look like you belong. Look like you belong when you're there. Look like you belong. You know, it did not escape me that there are many mentions of cars in this book and how cars drive, the features of the cars, how cars come together. And I know your dad was a car illustrator, and this drive, pun intended, your interest in cars and putting them into the books these ways.
Well, you know, it's just kind of, it's, you know, it's probably someone who is interested in fashion will describe what every character's wearing. You know, I just love cars. So I usually think, well, you know, we have to know what he's driving. And of course the last book I had done, it was a little offshoot and it was entirely about cars. It was about self-driving vehicles running amok. So it always ends up, it's funny, a friend of mine, a professor, he said, he was, when years ago, he was introducing me at something, he said, in every Lynwood Barclay book, you'll always know what everyone's driving.
Yes, it's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. And the cars and where they're going to go. And even in the last book, it was the blue car, it was this car, you knew all about the cars.
But I mean, it's like, you know, like, don't go away, I'm going to grab a book here. So it's just, When I did this book, Look Both Ways, I was able to put onto the title page this illustration.
Yeah.
Which that is not a photograph. That is an airbrushed illustration of a 59 Cadillac. And my dad drew that car. That's what he did for a living. He worked in advertising and was a car illustrator. And so I grew up surrounded by automotive imagery. You know, and I'm told that when I was 2 years old, my parents could stand me on the sidewalk and I could identify every car going by. That's a Buick. That's a DeSoto. I knew them all.
Wow. What did he drive? What did your dad drive?
What did my dad drive? For the most part, he drove mostly for a while he was driving Fords because he was doing the Ford account.
Okay.
And so we had a 55 Ford station wagon, then a 1959 Ford Fairlane, and a 60 or 61 Ford station wagon. And then when he stopped working in advertising, he got a Dodge Polara. But about a year and a half before he died, we were at a Dodge lot, and they had on the lot a Dodge Charger, this beautiful Dodge Charger. I said, Dad, you should trade in this boring Polara and get that. And he said, oh, your mother would never, ever go for that. And 2 days later, he came home with it.
Wow, I love it.
Such a sweet car. It was such a great car. And the sad irony of it is that when I was 16, he died. And my mom didn't drive. And by default, that was my car. Because I did all the family driving. I took my mom to a place. I did all that. So I had this fabulous cool car to drive around in, although I wish I had come by it a different way.
Yeah. That's not the way you want to come up the car. My dad for years was the Buick guy, and then he was Oldsmobiles. And then after that, he's driving a Lincoln right now and a Toyota Camry. Like, he still's got my mom's Toyota Camry. And we just sit there like, it's like so bizarre, you know, just so, but it's like, he loves cars. My dad goes out and waxes the cars all day long. Like, he just loves doing this, keeping the cars clean. You get in his car, you think it's like brand new. He'll go, look at this one. It's only got 25,000 miles on it. Every time
I'm an absolute fanatic about a clean car.
Yep. He's a fanatic about a clean car. The other day we went into the garage and we said, my husband goes like this in the car, and he goes, hey, Al, look, there's dust on the car. My father goes, oh, you should see the other side where the woman hit me. Now, I just want you to know, I talked to my 93-year-old father every night. Never came up as a subject. Never heard about the car. Meanwhile, he's had the accident. It is the woman's fault, believe it or not. He's 93. It's her fault. And it's on the police report. And he's already gotten the estimate for getting the car fixed. But have I heard one word about this? No, not one sentence about this. And I said to my husband, like, seriously? Yeah. So that brings me to, there's also a lot of humor in your writing. And when Jack loses the job before it even starts, you even drop the humor into the names of these niche magazines. He's going to be working for these magazines that are like, you know, what is it? The one that they think is going to work is still the Winnebago one, but the others are just not going to work anymore. I was cracking up.
Yeah, you know, and he's all these sort of bizarre trade magazines that really exist. You know, what's really funny is last year I made the cover of Mechanical Engineer in Canada, because they just like to, in every issue, have some sort of little interview with somebody who's well known to sort of boost their circulation. So I'm on the cover of Mechanical Engineer. My daughter-in-law, I thought we'd have to send her to the hospital. She laughed so hard. And so, but there's all these little niche magazines. And I mean, I should know, I'm a guy who buys Model Railroader every month. And so I remember my mom used to buy, when we ran this trailer park, you know, when I was a kid, which I took over running up to 16, you know, she subscribed. Who knew there was a magazine called Trailer Life? Because I'm going to tell you, living in a trailer is not a life. It's just not a life. So he's working for this like RV Life and, you know, all these ridiculous trade magazines. And of course, he gets fired on the first day on the job because of, I won't get into that. But
there's no business. There's no advertising business. I love this backstory, except for the Winnebago one. Everything else.
Yeah, they're doing well. But they had one of the trade magazines is for operators of movie cinemas, which just went dark during the pandemic. So that one just died. And of course, the other thing they do is they'll write articles, not because they're good articles to write, but because they'll write about an advertiser. So then they'll buy an ad in the magazine, what we call advertorial,
totally,
which is the curse of the industry.
I remember doing advertorials when I was at the magazine. It's like, we're going to do an advertorial and we're going to write about it. I'm like, I can't even believe we're doing this, you know? So people are saying this is your best book. And I'm hearing that from people, heard it from our reviewer. I know you're hearing it as well. What do you think it is that people are like attracted to with the book? What do you think it's turning them on?
I think sometimes the author is the last one to know. It didn't occur to me that it was my best. A very good friend of mine, he said, absolutely, this is your best one. And so it seems rude to argue, you know, like, no, you're wrong. It's just, I still think the best book I read was Trust Your Eyes, which was like 10 years ago or whatever. But I think there's something about the title, the Lie-Maker. So just about everybody thinks that it must be about, name the politician you dislike most.
Right, you know, right. Yeah, there you go.
It's got to be about some sort of politician. So I think I think that the title is kind of hitting a nerve. But and also the sense of you know, being abandoned as a kid, I think also. I mean, that's, you know, when I did a book back in 2008 called No Time for Goodbye, which was about that, and that was my biggest book I've ever had. So, you know, maybe it's that, but I mean, I think when you write a book as an author, you're the last one. It's like, is this any good? Or is it just terrible? And people will let you know.
Was this always the title?
No. My original story title was Backstory, which I thought was a good title, although it happened to be also the title of one of Robert B. Parker Spencer novels about 25 years ago. But we thought that was long enough ago, but nobody in the publishing house got excited about that. So we went around for a while, and then actually I came up with that. And everybody liked that.
I really, really like it. I really, really do. Was this always the cover? Like going out to nowhere?
It was another cover, and the UK cover is completely different. But then we came up with that. They had an earlier version, which I was less fussy about. And then I had some suggestions, and then they came back with this, and I thought, oh, I like that. That's very movie. Right.
No, it's really, really, really terrific. The audio is narrated by Jonathan McLean and Graham Halstead. What role are they each playing? Do you know if they're doing different voices or how
that I'm not playing? That I'm not sure about, but I have an interesting story quickly about Jonathan McLean.
Oh, good. Okay. We like stories.
So this is one of those small world stories. So a few months ago, we were watching, trying to pick a movie, Nathan and I, my wife and I, what we watched tonight. And I heard good things about this movie with Mark Rylance, this great character actor called The Outfit. Mm. And he plays a cutter, a guy who makes suits. And the movie feels like it's made in the 40s or 50s. And it's a really terrific, I highly recommend it. It's really great. It's the light's hitting my face. It's really weird. I'll just go this way. It's this really great thriller that involves sort of these mob guys, and his tailor shop is kind of a drop-off point for payments and so forth. Anyway, it's like a play. It's almost all, the whole thing takes place in this one location. And I really loved it. So I tweeted about how much I love this movie. So one of the two people who wrote the screenplay saw this on Twitter and replied to me. And that was Jonathan McLean, who co-wrote the screenplay. But Jonathan McLean said, I was so thrilled that you liked this movie I wrote because, don't know if you know this or not, but I have narrated some of your audiobooks.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And so I put in a word for him, and he did The Lion Maker.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. I'll try to figure out what each one is doing, but that one sounds great. That really sounds terrific. So what's next? Because you probably have it finished already. You probably have draft one done, yes?
I have delivered next year's book. Mm. I haven't gotten the tests back, the results back from the doctor on that one.
I've used that quote of yours so many times because people say, well, I'm waiting to hear. And I said, Linwood Barclay says it's like the test from the doctor.
Yep,
because then you're the delivered guy.
And I've actually started writing something that's a little out of my wheelhouse. I have about a third of a book done that's more sort of horror supernatural, which mm-hmm. is a departure for me. But I've started on that, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I'm not sure if it'll be my main book for 1 year or whether it'll be something else, but I'm messing around with that.
But you know what? It's like what you have fun with is what you want to go get to the table and write with every day. If you don't like what you're doing, it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. So,
Absolutely. Well,
this completely worked for me. I realized that when I pulled this, my husband still had a little more to leave, and now he has to figure out where it came from because this was his bookmark. I just was like, oh my gosh, I just lost his place. But he was loving it, absolutely loving it. I think he stopped reading it for like golf or something like that, you know, something that he, you know, felt important in his life. But no, it's really, really terrific book. And anybody who picks it up, really, I'll start early in the day because it's a page turner, but you're also later on sitting and really thinking about the book. And that's what I really love is not only when I finish a thriller, I go back and I think of how there were these little clues there that you didn't see. The only thing we didn't talk about is there are little sections that are just in italics. And it's, you're trying to figure out like who's talking to who, Jack talking to his father, like what is going on in these little italics. And later on, they're very, very telling of what happens in those moments as well. Because there's a lot going on in the book. Is that a good one?
Yeah, and I think it's got one of my, best little twists of anyone I've done, yeah.
Yeah, and the twist, but you know what happens is, twist at the end is boom, boom, boom. A lot of stuff, it doesn't do this, but at the end, you're going like this, going back and forth. And I think that that's one of the things, a lot of people draw you in at the beginning, but then the end is like, okay, it's just here, it's one. But this is not a one, it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, so which is like fabulous. Thank you as always for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. I want to see you in person one of these days again.
Yes, come down to the city, or come out here and visit us. You can stay here. You can sit by the pool. Talk about books. You can write. I'll give you a little office. Okay.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
And everybody else, we'll see you next time on Book Reporter Talks 2. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Liemaker, narrated by Jonathan McLean and Graham Halstead, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks 2. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks 2. This show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Liemaker, narrated by Jonathan McLean and Graham Halstead, courtesy of Harper Audio.
He could have someone out there, the man said, pulling back the front window curtains a tentative inch. Watching the house right now. He was careful not to step directly in front of the glass as he peeked outside. It was raining. Street lights reflected in the puddles. He ran his fingers nervously through his thick, dark hair. His handsome features were undercut by the fear in his eyes. He wasn't used to being afraid. He was unaccustomed to the role of prey. "He'll have found someone else to do his dirty work," he said. "Jesus, when are they going to get here?" He looked at his watch. "They're 10 minutes late. What the hell's keeping them?" He'd been directing his comments to his wife, a reedy, auburn-haired twig of a woman who looked ready to break into several pieces. She'd made several trips back and forth to the kitchen trying to keep busy. "Do you think they'll want coffee?" she asked. "They're not going to want any goddamn coffee," he snapped. She took a seat on the flowered couch, crossed her right leg over her left, then her left over her right. Some movement on the stairs caught her eye, and she spotted the 9-year-old boy sitting on one of the upper steps watching from between the railings, a tear running down his cheek. "Go upstairs," she told the boy. "I want to say good—" "Go to your room and close the door," she said, flinging her arm, pointing up. As she brought her arm back, she wiped a tear from her cheek. The boy sniffed and retreated from view, waited until his mother was no longer looking his way, then resumed his position. From where he sat, he could see the front door, the 3 suitcases sitting there, his father still watching the street. His mother was up again, walking around the couch, going into the kitchen. He could hear the rattling of cups, silverware. When she reappeared, her husband was still standing near the window. "Get away from there," she said. He let the curtain fall and stepped away. "It's not too late, Rose," he said. "The 2 of you can still come. They've prepared the documents in case you change your mind." She stood behind the couch, her hands resting atop the cushions as though using it as a barrier. Her jaw hardened and her eyes moistened. "If you're desperate for company, why don't you take your father?" she said. "Maybe he'd like to start all over again with you. He's all alone." "I can live without ever seeing him again. It's been years. But the 3 of us, we belong together. Once I walk out that door, once they put me in the car, that's it. It's not safe staying behind. If he can't get to me, he'll come after you." "And what would be the point of that?" she asked. "To get back at you? You've already washed your hands of us. And we certainly won't be able to tell him anything. You could be in Timbuktu for all we know. They can pull out all my toenails if they want, but I won't be able to tell them a thing." "We'll take our chances. Your new friends, they'll keep an eye on us." He took a step toward her, his face pleading. "I know I fucked up, that it's my fault, but we could start over, you, me, our son." "He has his friends. He'll make new friends," the man said. "They're not moving me to Mars." "No, more likely Butthole, Nebraska, running a bowling alley or picking up trash. It's better than being dead." She bit her lip. "Is it?"